fresher. In a few days you'll leave with me wherever I decide we have to go, and I'll start teaching you to draft." Kip hardly heard the last part, though. "The thresher?"
Chapter 27
Caris only fell a few feet through the floor before she hit something soft. Her left foot sank to the knee while the rest of her body continued falling into the basement. The sticky, whatever it was, held her leg as she fell, so she swung upside down, and the rest of her slapped into the side of something like a great red egg, a thin crust over gooey innards. She smacked into it, broke the side, and splatted into red Luxin. Then her fall pulled her free and she fell onto a stone floor. As she'd been trained, she flung her right hand down hard. The shock of slapping the floor hurt her hand. It always hurt, but that slap took the pressure off more vulnerable areas of her body and allowed her to guide the last part of her fall. She rolled, instead of landing on her head. In a moment, she popped up to her feet and pulled the thin-hilted ataghan from her pack. There was no light in the chamber except what spilled down through the hole she'd made in the ceiling. Chunks of wood were still falling into the hole. The great red egg shone in the sudden light. Settling smoke, stirred by Caris's fall, climbed the shaft of light surrounding the egg. The entire room, perhaps 20 paces by 30, stank of smoke and burnt red Luxin, which was odd, because red Luxin usually burned perfectly cleanly. For that matter, every surface illuminated in the weak light appeared to be blackened Luxin as well. But the great egg took all of Caris's attention. At least 7 feet tall, it was seared perfectly black, except where Caris had broken it. Red Luxin now oozed out of that wound like tar. A half dozen tubes snaked away from the egg in every direction, disappearing into the ceiling, each also blackened. The seared corpses of a dozen of King Haradul's soldiers lay about the room. "What in the hell?" Caris murmured. She lifted her sword to crack the egg open. The egg exploded before she could touch it. A great section of the front flew into her, the blackened shell shattering over her barely raised left arm, her chest, stomach, and legs. Caught in mid-step, she was thrown off balance. She stumbled and felt, more than saw, a form shooting backward out of the egg, even as the shell splattered over her. Instead of trying to catch herself, Caris flung herself into the fall. She rolled forward, tucking her ataghan in so she didn't skewer herself, and attacked. There was no hesitation. Iron Fist had pounded that lesson into Caris for years. When attacked, you counterattack instantly. The speed of that strike was often the only advantage you had, especially if you were small, especially if you were a woman, especially if you weren't wearing your spectacles and the other drafter was. Caris's attacker had backed all the way up to the wall. He stood with living coils of red Luxin, like giant knots around his hands. Caris knew that construction. If you knew what you were doing, you could hold extra open Luxin outside your body. Those knots of open Luxin could be formed into anything you wanted, and, held on your hands, you could actually fling them however you needed. The man stood like a trained fighter, too. Left side toward Caris, left hand up to block, but still with some springiness to throw out an attack, right hand higher and pulled back, right knee bent deeply, holding most of his weight. Even with Caris's speed with drafting and the amount of red Luxin here to reflect red light to her eyes, it still took some time to ready an attack, and he had the drop on her. Her only hope was to close the distance between them before he killed her. His left hand flicked out, right to left, low. Red Luxin glummed on the floor to slow her. She was expecting it, and she stutter-stepped over the sticky patches. Her right hand snapped forward in 3 sharp jerks. 3 balls, each the size of a fist, whipped out right to left. Caris dodged the first and second, but the third caught her as she had to stutter-step again to miss another sticky patch on the floor. It thumped hard into the ribs on her left side, then splattered. She rolled with it, spun into range, and slashed with the ataghan. The red drafter met her descending sword with layer after layer of red Luxin. Held Luxin, even red Luxin, could gain a certain degree of rigidity from the drafter's will, and more from being woven, but red Luxin could never stop steel. It was like pitting water against a sword. But this wasn't just a bit of held red Luxin. It wasn't like slapping a sword into still water. It was like standing below a dam when they opened the floodgates. It was only water, but the speed and volume of it would blow a man off his feet. Likewise, the Red Luxin hitting Caris slowed her more, and finally brought her to a complete halt. The Red Drafter's face paled as the Luxin drained out of him. Next, his neck and chest went back to their natural hue as the torrent continued, then his muscular shoulders, the Luxin being bleached out of his body from eyes to extremities. They both realized he was running out of Luxin at the same time. Caris broke off her attack at the same time he did. She fainted to his right, expecting to meet more Red Luxin, and set up a killing blow. Instead, her sword clanged against something hard. But she didn't see any sword. He couldn't have drawn one without her seeing it, not even in this darkness. Not hesitating, she lifted the ataghan and brought it down toward his head. It clanged and stopped as he lifted his hands in a V. He shoved her hard backward and followed, keeping close. The shaft of light piercing the gloom of the room illuminated his hands and what he was holding as he shouted, "Enough! Damn you, stop for 1 second!" The drafter held a pistol in each hand, crossed, their barrels holding Caris's ataghan prisoner between them. His right pistol stared at her right eye, his left at her left eye. Caris had her other knives and the bichoir, of course, but there was no way she could draw any of them before he could pull a trigger. The pistols staring at her were of Elysian design. The Elysian renunciation of magic usually meant their mundane tools were the best. With pistols, however, it was still dicey. This drafter had wheel-lock pistols. They negated the need to keep a fuse burning, but the flints failed to ignite the black powder at least 1 time in 4. Unfortunately, both pistols were double-barreled, and all 4 hammers were raised. Caris tried to do the figures. Was it 1 time in 16 or 1 time in 256 that all 4 shots would fail? Her heart despaired. She wasn't going to gamble on those odds. Not even 1 in 16. So, talking.
"What do you draft?"
the man demanded, his voice strained.
"I don't know what you're talking."
"What do you draft?" he screamed.
He flung her ataghan aside and put 1 pistol directly against her forehead. It was too dark for him to see her irises, but he was going to figure out soon anyway. So Caris said,
"Green. Green and red."
"Then draft a ladder and get out, now!"
Another time Caris might have been irked that she obeyed so promptly, but her spectacles were on her face in an instant, and she turned toward the light. Everything in this chamber was covered with either open red Luxin or blackened, seared, closed red Luxin. Finally she found an ironwood beam up in the temple that reflected a pure enough white light to allow her to draft a good, solid green. Even as her body filled with green, she saw why the drafter was so urgent. The chamber was filled with red Luxin. She shouldn't have put it together so slowly. There were 2 entrances to the room, and the dead soldiers were seared, but not roasted to death, and the red Luxin had remained, coating everything rather than burning as it should have. And it still remained. This room was full of red Luxin, old and new. They were inside a powder keg. A burning pew fell over, spilling smouldering and flaming brands toward the hole. 1 tottered on the edge, promising death. Caris ran forward, throwing down green Luxin thick enough to stand on. She drafted what was effectively an impossibly narrow staircase, the steps only wide enough to hold her feet, only strong enough to hold her weight if she concentrated her will. But it only had to last for 2 seconds while she sprinted out. And it did. She stepped, 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 fleet-footed as a hind, and vaulted, landing on the church floor. She felt a bit of the floor give way to drop into the chamber below, so she rolled again and kept running for the open front door. That much red Luxin in the basement meant the whole thing could whoomp. The explosion made the floor jump beneath Caris's feet. It hit just as she was pushing off of a step, and it flung her like a spring. The yawning open doors of the church yawned wider, and she was lifted and thrown forward. For a moment she thought she would make it through them and be flung harmlessly outside, but she'd been lifted high by the explosion. Too high. The ironwood frame above the door loomed. Then her upper body smashed into it and through it. The burned, weakened ironwood gave way after only an instant, but the instant it held was long enough for her to be spun viciously upside down, flipping so fast she didn't even know how many times she tumbled. Then she was skidding on cobblestones and gravel, not sure if she'd blacked out for a second or exactly how she'd come to the ground. She turned over, ignoring the just-starting screams of protest from all too much of her body, and looked toward the mangled front door of the church. A giant crimson snake, all aflame, stabbed its head out the front door. No, not a snake. A tube of pure red luxin, a fire, the width of a man's shoulders. Then the serpent vomited, and just a little faster than fire could curl up the flammable red luxin, the drafter was shot clear of church and fire and luxin alike. He landed not far from Caris, and far more gracefully, rolling to bleed off speed and finally standing. He scanned the streets on every side and, seeing no one, only then allowed himself to relax a little. But once he did, Caris could see the bone-deep weariness steal over him. Drafting as much magic as she'd just seen left him looking about as bad as she felt, deathly pale and tottering on his feet.
"Come on," the drafter said. "I think Haradul's soldiers are all gone, but if not, they'll be here soon after what you just did. We need to go."
Caris stood, wobbled, and would have fallen if he hadn't grabbed her.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Corvin Danavis," the drafter said, "and if I don't misremember, you're Caris Whiteoak, aren't you?"
"Danavis?" she asked.
Or Hollum, how she hurt.
"You were Dazens, a rebel. I can make it on my own, thank you."
She shrugged off his help, leaned crazily to one side, then the other, and finally collapsed. He watched, arms folded, and didn't catch her. Her shoulder hit the ground, and the world swam. Caris saw Corvin's boots come close. He was probably going to leave her here for the soldiers. She deserved it, too. Stupid, stubborn girl. Chapter 28. The dory Gavin drafted while they were still 5 leagues from Little Jasper Island was modelled on one he'd seen an Eburnean wild drafter use, with high sides and a flat bottom, a pointed prow, and a flat bow plate. It was safer and far less efficient than the sculls Gavin preferred, but that was the point. Not many drafters dared to use a scull on the ocean, because if you were going to use a scull on the ocean, you had to be willing to fall in the water. That meant being confident of getting out of the water solely by drafting. And not many drafters had the skill or the will to swim in rough seas and draft at the same time. Gavin's skill, or recklessness, meant his usual silhouette on the open sea was instantly recognizable. He didn't want that. Thus, the dory. Kip was sulking, nervous about the thresher and Gavin's refusal to tell him anything about it. Within a couple of leagues, they passed 2 merchant galleys and a galleass. Each time a mate inspected them through a spyglass, saw Gavin's muddled clothes and no distress flags, and rowed past without a word. There was little wind today, so the sailors got to rest while galley slaves manned their banks of oars. Each time he encountered another ship, Gavin waved gamely when the spyglass came out and returned to his own oars. What people called the Cromeria was really 2 islands, Little Jasper, covered entirely by the Cromeria itself, and Big Jasper, home to embassies, merchants' estates, shops, stalls, taverns, brothels, prisons, flophouses, tenements, warehouses, ropemakers, sailmakers, ore-turners, fishermen, convicts, slaves, and far more than its fair share of graspers, schemers, and dreamers. Big Jasper had 2 large natural harbours, one on the east that provided natural protection during the dark season, and one on the west for the light season, when the storms came from the east. As the island had grown in population and importance, breakwaters had been built on each side so both harbours could be used year-round. After several occupations, which had never touched the Cromeria, but had purged Big Jasper in fire and blood, a wall had been built to encircle the entire island. 30 paces thick and 20 high, it was now used mostly by the city's runners to spot and stop crimes in the streets below. Gavin's business was on Little Jasper, but he couldn't dock in its single, smaller harbour without being seen by spies from every one of the 7 satrapies. Even Tyria would have a spy watching those who were important enough to dock there directly, so he rowed them between the 2 islands. Between the jaws of Little Jasper's U-shaped harbour was Cannon Island. Only 20 men were garrisoned there at any time, and there were always 2 drafters on duty, ostensibly because of the hazards of docking on the island when there was anything more than the gentlest tide and lightest wind. It was a loathed posting, and one from which not even the blackguards escaped. It was thought that the white kept the roles restricted to higher-ranked Cromeria guards in order to be able to teach humility to a certain class of men and women who tended to be a little more brash than was good for themselves. And indeed, the white and the black did use postings to Cannon Island as punishment, but only for trusted soldiers. The fiction worked better if it was half true. When other soldiers traded postings, "I'll take your Cannon Island post next week if you'll just take my rounds this next weekend," the watch commander noted the names of anyone who switched. Those were then watched carefully while they were on duty, and more carefully afterward. Spies had certainly infiltrated the island, which was strategically important for purely mundane reasons, but none had yet, the white believed, penetrated Cannon Island's real importance. Amid the crashing waves of high tide, Gavin brought the dory around the back of the island. With his drafted multitude of oars, he had far greater control than he would have had over a mundane boat, but it was still tricky business to line up with the rollers erected long ago so boats could be pulled clear of even storm-height waves. They'd been seen, of course, and 2 blackguards were always given the boat duty, greeted them. The men, imposing brothers with coal-black skin, recognized Gavin instantly. Each held up a hand, not in greeting, but to give Gavin a stable target. He aimed superviolet at each hand, stuck it there, and then flung a coil of green luxin along that stable thread. Like rope, the luxin stuck in each big man's hand. Gavin fastened the other ends directly to the boat with 2 small globs of red luxin. The men pulled him in expertly. The dory rattled as it settled awkwardly from the waves onto the rollers, and then slipped smoothly up the ramp. Commander Ironfist, the elder brother, spoke first, as always.
"Sir?"
His eyes flicked down to Gavin's tattered clothes. The "sir" was his laconic equivalent of course I recognize you, but if this is supposed to be a disguise, I'm smart enough not to ruin it. What do you want us to call you today?" "I'll need a blackguard to take Kip to the Cromeria, Commander. I've told him about the escape tunnel, by the by, so keep an eye on him." Both men absorbed that in displeased silence.
"We'll need to wait until low tide for," Tremblefist began.
"Immediately," Gavin said, not raising his voice. "He's to be put through the thresher. No rush, tomorrow will be fine. Report the results to the White. Tell her Kip is my nephew." Ironfist's eyebrow twitched and Tremblefist's eyes widened. Kip, on the other hand, looked stricken. Gavin looked at the boy, but Kip seemed suddenly shy. "I'll see you tomorrow," Gavin said. "You'll do fine. After all, you've got my blood." He smirked. Kip looked baffled.
"You mean you're not saying I'm not your, bastard?"
Kip himself looked confused with all the negatives. No, I'm not disavowing you. When I say nephew, everyone knows what it means. It's just more polite. And it pays to be polite where the white is involved." Ironfist coughed. He could cough quite pointedly. Gavin looked at him pointedly in return. Ironfist adjusted his gotra, his checkered Parian headscarf, as if oblivious.
"But how do people know I'm not really your nephew?" Kip asked.
He was still clutching the luxin oar Gavin had drafted for him. "Because they'll pause, like it's delicate, and not say your surname. This is Kip, the Lord Prism's nephew. Not, this is Kip Guile, the Lord Prism's nephew. You see?" Kip swallowed.
"Yes, sir."
Gavin looked across the waves to the Prism's tower. He hated being gone overnight. His room slave Mauricia would dye the bread and throw it in the chute for the prisoner, and he knew he could trust her, but that was different from doing it himself. He looked back to the frightened boy. "Do me proud, Kip." Chapter 29 Kip watched the Prism head out across the waves with something akin to panic. Gavin was so in control of everything, so fearless, and now he'd left him. With 2 unfriendly giants. As Gavin finally disappeared from sight, Kip turned to look at the men. The scarier one, Iron Fist, was putting on blue spectacles with large oval lenses wrapped close to his eyes. As Kip watched, the blue Luxin filled the man, but it was almost invisible against his coal-black skin. The whites of his eyes already looked blue when you saw them through the blue lenses, so it wasn't until the skin under his fingernails turned icy blue that Kip was sure he hadn't just imagined the Blackguard was drafting at all.
"Grab a rope," Iron Fist told his brother, "with a float on it."
Tremblefist disappeared, leaving Kip with his brother.
"I don't know why you've been trusted with this island's secret," Iron Fist said, "even if you are his nephew. But now that you know, you're a guardian of it like the rest of us, you understand?"
"He did it so if I betray him, men like you will come kill me for him," Kip said. Was he never able to keep his mouth shut?
A look of surprise flitted across Iron Fist's face and was quickly replaced with amusement.
"A deep thinker, our friend," he said, "and a young man with ice water in his veins. How appropriate!"
From the "our friend," Kip understood that they weren't even to say the Prism's name here, not even now, with the wind whipping around them and the possibility of eavesdropping nil. It was that kind of secret.
"The story is you and your master, a scribe, came out on a friend's boat to...
"To study some local fish," Kip asked.
"Good enough," Iron Fist said. "He didn't account for the waves and had no skill with boats. He tried to bring you here for shelter, your dory capsized, and he was lost. We pulled you out of the sea."
"Oh, to account for why he isn't here if any of the others saw us coming in," Kip said.
"That's right. Hold tight."
Kip was holding a Luxin oar up between himself and Iron Fist, but he almost didn't get what the big man meant until too late. With a quick, snapping punch, Iron Fist lashed a hand through the Luxin and stopped it so close that Kip flinched. He barely even noticed the Luxin crumbling to dust in his fingers. He had a sudden urge to urinate.
"I don't know if you've given your sire reason to suspect you," Iron Fist said, "but if you betray him, I'll tear your arms off and beat you with them."
"Good thing I'm fat, then," Kip shot back.
"What?"
Incredulous. "Soft arms."
Kip grinned, thinking Iron Fist had been kidding. The stony, flat, willing-to-kill look on the big man's face made Kip's grin break and disintegrate like broken Luxin.
"That fat'll make you float, too. Get in the water," a cold voice behind him said.
Kip flinched. He hadn't even heard Tremblefist approach. The man was carrying a hollow log with numerous knotted ropes and loops attached. The wood was carved with several handles, too, so it would be easy to throw into the sea. A swimmer could then grab whatever length of rope he needed. Tremblefist handed the log to Kip, and Iron Fist rang a loud bell.
"Man overboard!" Iron Fist shouted. "We've got two in the water!"
"Move it," Tremblefist said, "and you better get completely wet fast. Help will be here in seconds."
Kip clutched the hollow log and jogged down the ramp between the rollers. The first big wave knocked him cleanly off his feet. His head smacked one of the great wooden rollers, and he saw stars. Then the water was over him. The water was shockingly cold at first. It was a cold that you quickly got used to. The Cerulean Sea was fairly warm, but Kip didn't have moments. He gasped and inhaled salt water as another wave passed over him. As he coughed his lungs clear, flapping his arms like an injured bird, he could feel the riptide grab him. Where was the log? He'd lost it. It was gone. Someone was shouting, but he couldn't hear what they were saying over the crash of the waves. The swells were only a pace high, but it was enough to blot out Kip's vision. He turned in a circle. There was a bell, ringing, ringing. Kip turned toward it, and despite the swells, he could see the looming black of Cannon Island. It was still receding. He started swimming. A wave pummeled him, drove him under the water, and spun him. He kicked, kicked, trying not to panic, failing. He had no air. Or Hollum, he was going to die. He kicked, desperate. He bobbed to the surface like a cork, but he was lost once more. His panic receded. He'd floundered somehow to the side of the riptide, and now the waves were bringing him in toward Cannon Island, but not toward the boat ramp. He was headed for the rocks. He swam hard sideways toward the sound of the bell. He was rising with one of the swells when he saw something impossible. Iron Fist, with a rope tied around his chest, was running through the air. He was wearing blue spectacles, and both of his hands were pointed down. He was hurling blue Luxin toward his feet, sprinting, making a platform to stand on even as he ran. As Kip watched, the blue Luxin platform, anchored only somewhere back on Cannon Island, cracked with a report and began to crash toward the waves. Iron Fist leapt as the platform fell, releasing the Luxin and executing a perfect dive. He surfaced right next to Kip, his spectacles and gotra ripped off by the waves, and grabbed Kip with one arm. Then the men on the beach began pulling in the rope as fast as they could. In less than a minute, Kip and the big man were staggering up the ramp. Well, Iron Fist was striding, one hand holding a fistful of Kip's shirt in case he fell, and Kip was staggering on jellied, naked legs.
"We couldn't save your master, son, I'm sorry," Iron Fist said.
There were a dozen soldiers crowded on the narrow portico outside the back door of Cannon Island. One threw a blanket over Kip's shoulders.
"Take this young man inside and take care of him," Iron Fist commanded. "I've got business on Big Jasper. I'll take him with me and notify the family. 10 minutes.
As the soldiers ushered Kip inside, he heard Iron Fist swear quietly,
"Damn, those were my best blue specks."
Chapter 30 Liv Danavis walked briskly over the Luxin Bridge called the Lily's Stem that connected the Cromeria on Little Jasper Island to the markets and homes on Big Jasper Island, trying to ignore the tension knotting her shoulders. She was wearing rough linen pants, a cloak against the chilly wind of the bright morning, her dark hair pulled back in a ponytail, and the same sensible low-leather shoes she'd worn when she'd first come to the Cromeria as a terrified 14-year-old. She always felt the temptation to dress up in her nicest things when she was summoned, but she always resisted. Her rich, imperious handler would make her feel shabby no matter what she wore, so she might as well be defiant. If Dazen Guile had won the prison's war, Liv would be Lady Oliviana Danavis, the daughter of the celebrated General Corvin Danavis. Being Tyrian would have been a badge of honour. She wouldn't have owed anyone anything. But Dazen had been killed, and those who sided with him disgraced. Her own father, narrowly avoiding execution despite being held in higher esteem than any general on either side. So now she was plain old Liv Danavis from Recton, the Dyer's daughter, and Hrothgar owned her contract. So what? She wasn't scared of being summoned. Much? Despite having been on Jasper Islands for the last 3 years, Liv hadn't come over to Big Jasper very often. The other girls came every week to listen to minstrels, get food not made in the Cromeria kitchens, meet boys who weren't drafters, shop and drink too much after examinations. Liv couldn't afford any of those, and didn't want to ask charity of anyone, so she begged off, always saying she needed to practice or to study. The benefit of that was that she wasn't yet jaded to the wonders of Big Jasper. The entire island was stuffed with buildings, but nothing was haphazard, unlike back home or in Garriston. The buildings were white stucco, blindingly bright in the sun, rising in terraces with the shape of the land. Geometric shapes dominated, hexagonal buildings and octagonal buildings topped with domes. Every building large enough to justify one, and many that weren't, sported a dome, and the domes were every colour in the rainbow. Blue domes, the colour of the cerulean sea, beaten gold domes on the homes of the rich, copper domes turning gradually green and scrubbed every year to gleam again at Sunday. Domes painted the colour of blood, mirrored domes, and with the domes the doors, too, were beautiful. It was as if all the irrepressible personality of the Jasperites rebelled against the conformity of their white walls and similar-shaped homes, but only in the decorating and designing of their doors. Exotic woods, chiselled patterns from every corner of the Seven Satrapies and beyond, doors apparently carved of living wood with leaves still growing from the tree people, Tyrian horseshoe arches, Parian chessboard patterns, huge doors to small buildings, keyhole doors in huge edifices. But at least as iconic as the coloured domes and shining white walls of Big Jasper were the thousand stars. Every street was laid out perfectly straight, and at every intersection stood pairs of narrow arches, thin, looking impossibly spindly on their white legs, at least 10 stories tall, connecting high above the intersection in a groin vault. Mounted on swivels at the pinnacle of the groin vault was a circular mirror, highly polished, flawless, as tall as a man. With the special layout of the streets, as soon as the sun conquered the horizon, light could be directed anywhere. Long ago the builders had said, "In this city there will be no shadow that Orholm's eye cannot touch." Day was longer on Big Jasper than anywhere in the world. The original purpose, as near as Liv could guess, had been to extend the power of drafters on the island. In other densely populated cities, the buildings eventually crowded out the sun. Not only did that make a city feel dark, but it meant drafters walking down those streets were vulnerable. The buildings here were separated carefully according to height and width, leaving light wells. But with the 1,000 stars, a drafter could have as much power available to her as she could handle, for hours longer than she would otherwise. On Sunday, every one of the 1,000 stars was slaved to the prism. Everywhere he walked, every mirror turned, illuminating him. Obviously some beams were blocked by buildings, but no matter where he walked, even in the poorest areas, at least a few had unobstructed views. Indeed, before anyone built a building, their plans had to pass inspection that they wouldn't interfere with the 1,000 stars. Only a very few had been able to circumvent the rules, like the Guile Palace. Of course, Liv thought, the same rules don't apply to the obscenely rich. Never do. Not here. Every principality in the city was allowed to determine how it wished to use its stars when they weren't needed for defense, law enforcement, or religious duties. Some moved their stars in rigid schedules, making a light clock that everyone in the district could easily see. Today, the first principality Liv walked through, the embassies, was having a market day. They'd fitted diffuse yellow lenses over half of their stars, lighting an entire great square with cheery light. A half dozen yellow drafters, hired specially for the occasion, were, without spectacles, juggling bright water, liquid yellow luxin. Dragons exploded in the air, great fountains of shimmering, evaporating yellow luxin shot skyward, drawing great crowds toward the market. The other half of the stars, fitted with lenses of every color, spun in great circles around the market in a dizzying display. Liv pitied the tower monkeys, the petite slaves, often children, who had to work the ropes here today. Among slaves, they were well treated, even paid, their work for the star keepers considered important, technically difficult and even holy, but they spent their days in 2-man teams in the narrow spindles, one spotting and one working the ropes with deft hands, often working from the first shimmer of dawn until the dark of night without reprieve, except for switching with their spotter. When the prism, or a superviolet, travelled and needed use of the stars, they could do so directly, magically. But every mundane purpose required the services of the monkeys. Idly, Liv considered reaching into a superviolet control line embedded in the street and taking control of a star just to wreak some havoc on the rich people's party. That was the beauty of being a superviolet. No one could tell you were drafting who couldn't also see superviolet. Still, it wasn't like she would be the first student to do such a thing. Punishments for such pranks were swift and severe. Liv's stomach was doing backflips, though. Despite the hubbub of the morning crowd and shouts of merchants and the singing of minstrels and the crackling of the bright water fireworks, nothing could distract her from her upcoming meeting. The crossroads was a coffee house, restaurant, tavern, the highest-priced inn on the Jaspers, and downstairs, allegedly, a similarly priced brothel. It was centrally located in the embassy's district for all the ambassadors, spies, merchants trying to deal with various governments, and drafters having just crossed the Lily's Stem, because the crossroads was housed in a former embassy building. As a matter of fact, it was in the old Tyrian embassy. Liv wondered if her handler had done that on purpose, or if she'd just chosen it because she knew it was far too expensive for Liv to afford. Liv hiked up the grand staircase to the 2nd floor where the Kopi House was. A beautiful greeter met her with a dazzling bright smile. The crossroads had the best staff in the city, every last man, woman, and table slave attractive, immaculately dressed, and unfailingly professional. Liv had always suspected that the slaves here earned more than she did. Not that that would be hard. Actually, it was Liv's first time inside.
"How may we serve you today?" the greeter asked. "We have some lovely tables by the south window."
She politely didn't stare at Liv's rough clothing. "A private table, if possible. I'll be meeting a friend from the Hrothgari embassy, Aglaia Krassos."
"Of course. I'll be sure to send her over."
The staff here knew everyone who was anyone, by name.
"Will you be needing muting for your table?"
"Muting?" "Oh." Liv tightened her eyes to see into the superviolet. Of course, she'd forgotten. She'd heard about this, too. A third of the tables here were surrounded by superviolet bubbles. The bubbles had holes, of course, or the patrons inside would suffocate, so the sound couldn't be completely cut off, but it would certainly help make sure it was 100 times harder to eavesdrop. Some of the bubbles even had small, spinning superviolet fans to blow fresh air into them, which, Liv realized, was eminently practical. Those patrons who had opted to have the bubble but not the fan looked uncomfortably warm. Liv was going to go way out on a limb and guess that the fan was available for a small additional cost. Now that she was looking, she realized the greeter was herself a superviolet drafter, her pupils bearing the halo barely a third of the way through her irises. No wonder Liv hadn't noticed right away. When a superviolet drafter got much further along, the color in their eyes began to bleed over into the visible range, lending a slight violet tinge that was difficult to see in brown eyes and made blue eyes astonishingly beautiful. Not that Liv was ever going to get that with her bland browns.
"Actually," Liv said.
She turned her cloak so the woman could see the back. It was common for superviolets to weave some extra pattern into their clothing so that other superviolets could identify them. The greeter's pupils tightened to pinpricks in a heartbeat as she glanced at Liv's cloak.
"Very finely done. Superviolets are welcome to draft their own muting. Just let us know you're going to be using muting when you visit so our servers don't make any mistakes."
The woman took Liv to a table by the windows on the south side, where she could get sunlight through open windows. There was plenty of sunlight here in the clerestory. The arches and flying buttresses supported all the way to the roof easily, so the second story had windows from floor to ceiling. But one of the downsides of being a superviolet was that thick windows like those used here interfered with light collection. Any skilled drafter could still use magic, but it took longer and gave some drafters headaches. Liv sat and watched how the staff worked, weaving effortlessly between tables, giving a wider berth to those surrounded by superviolet shells. A slender young serving man with short, kinky hair and a gorgeous smile came to her table, pausing just outside where her bubble would have been if she had already drafted one. He was probably only a few years older than her, and devastatingly beautiful, his jacket expertly tailored to a leanly muscled body. Somehow, she managed to give him her order. Just a copy, which would doubtless cost a full dinar. When he brought it back, steaming hot and dark as hellstone, and gave her a long smile, Liv decided the copy was definitely worth a dinar. Maybe more. Her good mood died at the sight of Aglaia Krassos climbing the stairs with her butt-puckered gait. The 20-something-year-old Hrothgari was, as best Liv could tell, the youngest daughter of some important family. She had the prized, vanishingly rare Hrothgari blonde hair, but other than that, she was no beauty. She had the blue eyes that were wasted on non-drafters, a long, horsey face and a huge nose. Stationed at the Hrothgari embassy to get some political experience before she married some fiancé she hadn't met back in the City of Wrath, she had always acted like she was too good to handle Liv. She'd even told Liv that being assigned Liv's case had been her punishment for some indiscretion with the Atashin ambassador's son. Mostly, she handled bichromes and polychromes and real spies. Catching sight of Liv, a glare came right over, giving a little wave to a few patrons and a wink to one.
"Oliviana," Aglaia said, coming to stand before her table, "you're looking so active this morning."
The pause said it all, the searching expression as if she was really trying to find something good to say. From some women it might have been an accident. "You want to play it like that?"
Fine. Such a pleasure to see you, Aglaia. You wear petty malice so well, Liv said.
Oops.
Aglaia's eyes widened momentarily, and then she faked a laugh.
Always were a sharp instrument to handle, weren't you, Liv? I love that about you.
She sat across from Liv.
Or is it just that you're too stupid to understand your situation?
My father told me not to come here. Sharks and sea demons, he said. I should have listened. I'm antagonizing the woman who holds my future. Liv licked dry lips, as if a little lubrication would help her force submissive words out.
I'm sorry. How may I be of assistance, mistress?
Aglaia's eyes lit up.
Say that again.
Liv hesitated, clenched her jaw, forced herself to relax.
How may I be of assistance, mistress? Draft us a bubble.
Liv drafted the muting bubble, complete with a fan.
Such a proud girl you are, Liv Danavus. The next time I have a party, I'll have to remember to have you come serve the food. Or perhaps clean the chamber pots.
Oh, I love cleaning chamber pots, and I love telling all my friends who haven't yet signed contracts how well the Hrothgari treat their drafters, Liv said. Aglaia laughed. She really did have an unpleasant laugh.
Well played, Liv. That was an empty threat, and I deserved to be called on it. You're from Rekton, aren't you?
Liv was instantly on her guard. Aglaia had let an insult pass. Liv would have expected that after being called on an empty threat, Aglaia would lay out a real one, and she had quite a few possibilities at her disposal. That she didn't should have made Liv feel better. It didn't.
Yes,
Liv admitted, there was no reason to lie. Nothing came from Rekton. Besides, Aglaia would have a record of where Liv was from. It was on her contract.
It's a small town. Inconsequential. Who is Lena?
What?
She's a serving woman, Catalina Deloria. Takes odd jobs.
An addict, a disgrace, and a nightmare of a mother. But Aglaia didn't need to know that, and Liv wasn't going to say anything bad about the folks back home.
Any family?
None, Liv lied. She settled in Rekton after the war, like my father did.
So she's not Tyrian?
You mean originally? I don't know. Some Parian or Elysian blood, maybe, Liv said.
Why? What's she look like?
Too skinny, with bloodshot eyes and bad teeth from smoking haze. Tall, short kinky hair, mahogany skin, stunning hazel eyes. Now that Liv thought about it, Lena had probably been a real beauty once.
And Kip? Who's he?
Oh, hell. Court.
Her son. Oh, she does have family, then.
I thought you meant, does she have any people around Rekton?
Right,
Aglaia said.
How old is Kip?
15 now, I suppose. Kip was nice, though it had been obvious the last time Liv was home that he was terribly infatuated with her.
What's he look like?
Why do you want to know all this? Liv asked.
Answer the question.
I haven't seen him for 3 years. He probably looks totally different now. Liv threw up her hands, but Aglaia didn't relent.
A bit chubby. A little shorter than me the last time I saw him. For a Hollum's sake, girl, his eyes, his skin, his hair.
Well, I don't know what you're looking for.
Now you do,
Aglaia said. Blue eyes. Medium skin, not as dark as his mother's. Kinky hair.
Half-breed?
I guess so. Though Liv couldn't have said what Kip's halves would be. Parian and Atashian? Elysian and Blood Forester? Something else? Probably not simple halves, whatever he was. Half-breed was a mean description, though, and completely unfair. The finest families and all the nobles in the Seven Satrapies intermarried far more often than commoners, and they were never called half-breeds.
Blue eyes, though. That's interesting. Not many people in your town with blue eyes, are there?
My father has blue eyes. There's a few among people who settled there after the war, but no, we're like the rest of Tyria.
Is he a drafter?
Of course he is. My father's one of the most famous red...
Not your father, idiot girl. Kip.
Kip? No. Well, not the last time I saw him. He was 12 or 13 then.
Aglaia sat back.
I should let you grope in the dark after your attitude today. But then you'd be even more likely to muss everything than you already are. I have an assignment for you, Liv Danavis. It turns out that my punishment of having to deal with you was Orholm's gift in disguise. We intercepted a letter this woman Lena wrote to the prism.
She what?
She claimed Kip was his bastard.
Liv laughed. It was so ridiculous. Aglaia's face said she wasn't kidding.
What?
Liv asked.
She said she was dying, and she wanted Gavin to meet his son Kip. We don't know if it's their first communication or not, but she didn't ask for anything or threaten him. Kip's the right age, and Gavin had blue eyes before becoming the prism. The rest is inconclusive, but the note was written as if it were true. As if Gavin knows her.
Aglaia smiled.
Liv, I'm going to give you an opportunity at a better life, and I hope I don't need to tell you that I can already make you have a much worse life if I so choose. You tested as a superviolet and a marginal yellow. For obvious reasons, your sponsor chose not to train you as a bichrome.
Yes, Liv knew it well. A bichrome was expected to be kept in a certain style, or it reflected badly on the sponsor and the sponsoring country. And yellow was so hard to draft well that few who were trained in yellow passed the final examination. So supporting a yellow bichrome was a huge investment with little possibility of a return. Liv's sponsor had pretended she wasn't a bichrome to save his money. It wasn't fair, but there was no one to speak up for Tyrians.
Here's your assignment, girl. I've maneuvered things so that your class will be up next for the prism's personal instruction. Get close to him.
You want me to spy on the prism? Liv asked. The very notion was nearly blasphemous.
Of course we do. He may solicit you for information about his son and this woman Lena. Use that opportunity. Become indispensable to him. Become his lover. Whatever you need to... What? He's twice my age. And that would be horrible if you were 40 years old. You're not. And it's not like we're talking about someone old and decrepit. Tell me the truth. You've already dreamed about him tearing off your clothes, haven't you? No, absolutely not.
Really, she just admired him. Every girl did that. But for Liv it had been completely abstract, platonic.
Oh, a saint you are. Or a liar.
I guarantee every other red-blooded woman in the Chromaria has dreamed about it.
No matter, you'll think about it now. You want me to seduce him? It is the easiest way to be in a man's room while he's sleeping. And if he wakes while you're rifling through his letters, you can pretend to be jealous and say you're looking for letters from some other lover. Truth is, we don't care how you get close to him, but let's be honest. What do you have to offer the prism? Witty conversation? Insight? Not so much. On the other hand, you're pretty for a Tyrian. You're young, not very bright, uncultured, not powerful, not a scholar or a poet or a singer. If you can get close to him some other way, great. I'm just betting the odds.
It was the most eviscerating way to be told you were pretty that Liv had ever heard.
Forget it. I'm not going to be your whore. Your piety is touching, but it's not whoring if you want to do it, is it? You've seen him. He's gorgeous. So you get a few extra benefits. You can enjoy him, you can bask in every woman's jealousy, you get everything that we offer. I don't want anything more from you. You should have thought of that before you signed your contract. But that's in the past. Liv, if we can get even one private meeting with Gavin Gyle, we will set you up as a bichrome. Get close to him and we'll make your rewards even richer than that. But spit in my face, and everything in your life can turn to hellstone. I have full power over your contract, and I will use it.
The offer of setting up Liv as a bichrome seemed awfully generous, just for getting one meeting with the prism, but she saw the logic behind it.
A prism could do what he wanted, but sleeping with a Tyrian monochrome would seem questionable, tasteless, slumming. A bichrome, on the other hand, at least had some standing. The truth was the offer was still probably generous and might make Gavin more suspicious of them, but the prize, having a spy next to the prism himself, was worth so much that the Hrothgari were willing to risk it. They needed Liv to say yes.
"Besides," Aglaia said, "if you're smarter than I think you are, you can find out for yourself who gave the orders to burn Garriston. You could find out who's responsible for your mother's death."
Chapter 31 Gavin had hunted down hundreds of colour whites, and this one didn't feel right. The madness struck every colour white differently, but blue whites always revelled in order. They loved the hardness of blue Luxon. Most eventually tried to remake themselves with it. Every one of them believed they could avoid madness if only they were careful enough, smart enough, and thought through every step. But what was a blue white doing crossing the reddest desert in the Seven Satrapies? Rondar Wit had been posted in one of the smaller coastal cities of Hrothgar. Married, 4 children, and a good relationship with his lord patron, who'd waited 2 weeks to report Rondar's disappearance. No one liked to believe that their friend might go mad. Gavin trudged through the desert. He'd stopped briefly at one of his contacts on the coast, got dressed entirely in red and armed, and still thought he should reach the white before dark. Still, he was exhausted. Skimming was fast, but his arms and shoulders and stomach and legs ached. His will felt sapped. He didn't get light sick when he drafted too much, but he did get tired and shaky. Coming near the top of a dune, he stopped so as not to skyline himself and drafted a pair of long lenses. Tracking blues was usually easy because no matter how smart they were, most couldn't bear to be illogical. If you figured out where they were going, you could guess they would take the most efficient route there. Gavin had no idea where this one was going, but he was following the coast. Unless his objective was nearby, Gavin was going to assume that the Geist would continue heading down the coastline, staying far enough from the coast to avoid farms and towns. Of course, this white had made a mistake, coming in too close from the desert for the sake of speed and access to water, and had been seen by a boy herding the rangy desert cattle the nomads kept. The boy had told his father, and his father had told everyone, including Gavin's contact. For a few days, the white would try to put as much distance between himself and the herders as possible. So Gavin made guesses, drafting blue to help himself think like one of them. Assuming the blue-white didn't have a horse that the boy hadn't seen, and horses usually hated colour whites, a man pushing hard through this desert could only move so fast. Gavin had been through here before, and though he didn't know it intimately, there were a number of points where a man had to decide if he wanted to follow the coastal road or take a trader's route through the cracked lands. And there were places where the cracked lands were so broken and treacherous that there was no discernible trader's route at all. Gavin wasn't going to choose one or the other. He waited at one of the places where the roads met and diverged. And waited. He untucked his shirt, pulled it askew, rebuttoned it, offset one button and tucked it back in. And waited. He drafted sub-red into fire crystals to bleed off heat from his body, watching the tiny crystals take shape, crinkle, and then flame out. Every 10 minutes, he trudged back high on the great dune to poke his head over and scan the desert. As the sun descended, he saw the telltale gleam. Aches forgotten, he was again a circling hawk, waiting for the marmot to step just this far from his hole. He felt the same spasm of black fury that he felt every time. He should kill it instantly, and not listen to its lies, its justifications, its haughty madness. No, this time he needed to listen. First. This Geist's skin was layered with blue Luxon. It wasn't just armour, it was a carapace. Chromaturgy changed all men, but blue whites were seduced by the perfections of magic. They sought to trade flesh for Luxon. This one had progressed further than most. Talented, then, not to mention meticulous and likely brilliant. It still wore blue pants and shirt, though both were dirty and, uncharacteristically for a blues personality, torn. So it thought it was almost done with the need for clothing, but either the dangers of exposure in the desert or the possibility of needing just a bit more blue to draft from had convinced the creature to keep its clothing for a little longer. Its face, though, was the true wonder, or horror, depending on how you looked at it. It had insinuated blue luxin beneath its very skin. Gavin had seen it before. The process had to be done slowly and carefully enough to not cause infections or rejection. But once begun, it had to be finished quickly. The skin lost feeling and began dying as soon as it was cut off from the body, so the white began sloughing off rotting skin. This one's forehead had split open, revealing robin's egg blue beneath peeling, necrotic skin. It had drafted blue covers for its eyes arcing from brow to cheekbones in a solid dome so that it would effectively always be wearing blue spectacles, but the result made it look like a bug with bulging blue eyes. It was, Gavin had always thought, one of the worst parts of geists trying to remake themselves. If all your skin died, your eyelids died. Even if you could draft a thin blue membrane every time you needed to clear your eyes, and it had to be held blue luxin because rubbing blue glass against your eyeballs was never a good idea, even if you deal with that, you could never close your eyes to sleep. Even whites needed sleep. An hour later, as the sun was almost touching the horizon, burning the desert beautiful, Gavin put on his borrowed red spectacles, gathered the red cloak around himself, cracked open a white mag torch, and stepped out in front of the geist. The blue-white convulsed. Blues hated surprises, hated not having foreseen something, hated having their plans disrupted. But they were also hard to read, the blue perfection of a luxin face preventing facial expression of emotions even as the magic in their veins slowly obliterated their capacity to feel them. But the surprise lasted only a moment. The geist sprinted straight for Gavin, its skin afire with blue, its eyes literally aglow, buggy, lit from within with refracting blue light. Gavin tossed the mag torch down in the sand in front of himself and threw open his red cloak, taking a wide stance on the side of the dune as the geist charged. Gavin's hand swept up past the weapons harness, little fingers of red luxin plucking all the tiny daggers from their sheaths. As he took one great step forward with his left foot, he drafted a dozen thin barrels along his arm. Then his right arm whipped forward with all the energy coiled in his body added to the force of his will. The dozen tiny daggers became steel missiles as he flung them. They flew at incredible speed, one after the other. A blue shield sprang from the white's left arm and blossomed huge to catch the splashing fire it expected from a red drafter with a mag torch. Instead, the steel daggers hit with a sound like hail on a tin roof. The shield pitted, cracked wide, and gaped open. The last three daggers sailed cleanly through. The first struck its cheek and deflected off its carapace, the next cut only the air next to its neck, and the last buried itself in the white's shoulder. The geist had already begun its counterstroke, though. It flung its right fist forward and five enormous spikes formed in the air around its hand, and stabbed for Gavin's stomach in a line so that even if he moved left or right, he'd still be skewered. Gavin cheated, of course. He drafted a solid platform beneath the sand to give himself a solid surface to jump off of and dove down the dune, flipping and landing in a great slide down the dune's face. The geist whipped around, dropping its luxin spears and drafting a blue great sword in their place. It saw that Gavin had lost his spectacles in his dive, and it twitched a smile. Its cheek had been sliced by Gavin's dagger, and a flap of skin peeled open, drooping toward earth, showing a cross-hatched network of blood vessels and blue luxin. Though the luxin was cracked and broken at the point of impact, capillaries oozing blood. The dagger in its left shoulder seemed to be hampering its motion, but it was nothing lethal.
"You reds,"
the geist said, its voice gravelly, as if it hadn't spoken in some time.
So impulsive. You thought you could take me alone just because it's sunset in a desert?
Gavin glanced at his spectacles lying on the sand above him. The Geist saw it and swung its great sword. The blade elongated in mid-air, closing the full 5 paces, and smashed the red spectacles to bits, then shortened again.
You should leave murdering the unchained to your prism, the Geist said.
The unchained? Gavin said, they told us the prism was too important for you. They told us we should be able to handle one blue-white in the middle of a desert. They said Rondar Wit wasn't that gifted. The Geist laughed.
Was that supposed to make me angry? I'm not Rondar any longer. The Prism's Empire crumbles over your head, slave. Join us. See what it is to be free. You have, what, perhaps 5 years left? Not long, not even for a drafter in their world. Why die for their false god? Why die for their lives? Why die ever?
The Geist was trying to recruit him. This was different. Gavin kept his eyes squinted. The less the Geist saw his eyes, the less likely it was to notice how odd they were. False god? Gavin asked. Immortality? Slime.